Monday.
Generational change.
I'm Jen.
I'm Peter. And it's a special day, isn't it?
Well, it's the day when everybody pretends to really give a crap about things that they obviously don't give a crap about.
Yeah, a little grandstanding here and there. But happy Martin Luther King Day.
As we can't get a Voting Rights Act passed.
Yeah, but of course the Voting Rights Act.
And it's all because of Joe Manchin.
No, but the Voting Rights Act that they're trying to pass, of course, has major poison pills, including the one about increasing the financial requirements in order to get on ballots and things like that. You know, anything to stymie a potential third party rise. I mean, we all know how that works.
But it has a lot of good things in it. It really does.
Sure.
So, you know,
you can't overlook that either.
No, but the fact that we can't get a Voting Rights Act bill passed at the same time as the same people are speaking about Martin Luther King, it's comical. Well, you can't make this up.
Well, like Senator Sinema posting Dr. King as her hero on social media today.
Oh, see, that to me
that's
is
like a deliberate. That's like deliberate, like trolling. As far
I
as
you know
it's
what?
Gotta be.
That's just. It's absurd. But yeah, she's got nerve.
How could anybody take it as anything?
Speaking
else?
Of people with that have the nerve, but in a good way. So I saw Nina get into it with one of Joe Manchin's staffers. Did you see that little interaction?
Yeah, I heard about that.
If you guys haven't seen it, I'm sure if you look up the clip of Nina getting into it, I think Kyle did a good clip on it too.
Well, Kyle usually does good clips.
With Joe Manchin. She was just not having any of it. And she basically threw down the gauntlet. She's like, if any of you people that are not supporting this Voting Rights Act dare mention the name MLK, like she just went off. She's like, you cannot quote him. You cannot, like, she brings the fire.
Nina's the Bethalia on Mr. King. So
I love her.
A lot of people today are obviously virtue signaling for things that obviously are important, but are not actually going to do anything to do what is necessary about it. But one of the things that Dr. King did talk about that was very important to him was universal health care, and how the most inhumane thing that we have in the United States is the fact that we don't have universal health care. There's nothing more inhumane than that. And so the gentleman who we are bringing in again, we are very pleased to welcome back to the show, Assemblyman, not Congressman.
And I, you know what? That makes it complicating. No, it makes it complicated. I say Assembly member. Because I feel like if you say Assemblyman, then they're going to get all, you know, gender haters out there. It's like Assembly member.
Yeah, we live in a world where everybody's offended.
Everything is offended.
But Assembly member of District 27 in California, Ash Kalra, who put forth Appropriations Bill 1400, which is CalCare, universal health care for the state of California. Now, this is going to be an interesting discussion because obviously this is a momentous occasion because it actually passed its first Appropriations Committee, which is huge. However, we have to have this conversation because we've got our MMTers who I'm sure are going to tune in and wonder, how are we going to pay for it?
How are they going to do it?
How are they going to do it?
They don't think it's possible to do this outside of the federal government.
Well, here's the thing, though. But isn't California the fifth or sixth largest economy in the whole world? I mean, I would think that if you have that much, you know, GDP, you probably could afford to.
But I don't think it's that as much as the whole concept of MMT, which is that they're not a currency issuer and they still rely. I mean, look, I'm just saying, and I hear the voice of the teacher from Charlie Brown or Steve Grumbine, you know, like.
But, be it as it may. We are very pleased to welcome back to the show Ash Kalra, the representative of California's 27th district. And that is an appropriate way of saying it.
I suppose.
Good to see you.
good to see you both. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, absolutely. Thanks for coming on. So we recently did have friend of the show, Steve Grumbine, on. And I don't know if you're familiar with Steve and modern monetary theory. I'm sure you are. And they're always, and for me, I'm like an optimist with this. And I also think you throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. So I support any and all efforts at any and all level to do things that help people. So, but they're very skeptical of the finances with this. And I don't completely understand it. It might be one of those things that I don't ever completely understand. But they don't know that it's possible to do it at a state level financially. What do you say about that?
Well, look, you know, the Canadian government, as an example, has provincially run healthcare programs. They do have the Canada National Health Act, but really that's just a funder into the state programs. The state actually operates the program, has state funding and federal funding. So on a parallel track, the reality is we would need federal funds, and that's what the Medicare waiver process is all about. the money, we're already getting an enormous amount of federal money for our healthcare system. In fact, the United States pays more for health, gets more public money spent for healthcare than any country in the world, which is crazy if you think about it. We're talking about compared to other countries that have single payer. And so we're already putting an enormous amount of money into it. Now, is it complicated? Would it be easy? Of course not. But this is a generational issue. And so the way it would work is that we would have to get Medicare waivers from the federal government so that we can use the federal funds instead of it go and have it come into CalCare. We combine that with state funds. The state and federal funds combined are the majority of healthcare costs already. The other big portion of it are premiums, employer premiums, worker premiums, individual premiums. When people buy healthcare on the Covered California, ACA exchange or what have you. And that's what we'd be getting rid of, is the cost to the employers and to individuals and to families, and instead have a progressive taxation system so that your healthcare is not attached to whether you're employed or not, whether you have good employment or not. As you know, again, other countries look at us and really justifiably think it's lunacy for us to have healthcare attached to employment. It shouldn't matter. And so is it possible? Yes. Is it easy? No. And so those that are skeptical, I understand it. I get why you'd be skeptical. But I met with the Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services in D.C. We met for over an hour with him and his team. It's absolutely doable. It does not require any additional federal legislation. Right now, the waiver process does allow for states to apply. And what we're trying to do would be eligible for that waiver application process.
That's really cool. Did I have the idea ready that we should have Ash and Gustavo on it, that like, and do a show? Do you know who Gustavo Rivera is from? He's the your counterpart in New York.
Yes. In fact, I met his assembly counterpart, Assemblymember Gottfried, who is considered the godfather of single payer in New York. He actually got elected to the assembly in New York before I was born. In 1971, that's how long he's been there. But he introduced the first single payer bill in the 90s. And now with Senator Rivera, they've introduced a bill that's moving through the legislature there as well. And so, it'd be great to connect with
them. Yeah, I think that would be cool.
Yeah, and I think that there's always the thing that I always take exception with the, you know, the MMT groups, the, you know, groups that are very much about, you know, it has to be done this way. My attitude is, how long do you think it's going to take to build enough momentum to pass single payer healthcare on Capitol Hill? You happen to be friends with Representative Ro Khanna. I can't even imagine what the conversation is like with somebody like him who supports universal healthcare, has to deal with, even with fellow reps in California who obviously have, you know, deep pockets from big pharma and private insurance. And that is a huge problem. I see California or New York or both as basically being, you know, the center points of being able to get this across the finish line, properly funded, and then expanding to the rest of the country, just as it happened in Canada. Would you say that that's the biggest pushback that you get, is this whole concept of, well, we're not having necessarily, you know, the Federal Reserve just put money directly into this. You know, we kind of have to balance the budget. But it seems like the budget is getting balanced. And I think that would speak to, you know, a great segue into the fact that it already has passed a very important committee in order to move forward.
Yeah, so I agree. Look, I mean, and I want to throw Washington State in there as well. I want to give them props. I know there's an effort there too.
Washington.
Yeah. And this is a healthy competition to bring healthcare justice to our community. And the reality is, look, DC can't even get Voting Rights Act legislation passed. And it's not, and I don't say that as a criticism to the Democrats that are trying, but let's be real. Do you really think DC is going to be able to do something of this nature? And at the end of the day, it is the states that have to lead. The states oftentimes lead on environmental issues, on marriage equality. I mean, you name it, on and on and on, on cannabis legalization. It hasn't happened federally yet, but a number of states have done it. It will happen federally because states have taken the lead. And so absolutely, I think it's not only possible, I think it's the only way it's going to happen is if a state leads, especially a state the size of California or New York. And, you know, built into our bill is the need to have reserves. And so, yes, we're in a great financial situation right now, you know, close to $50 billion surplus. But that won't always be the case. And so we have to have built-in reserves. And that's another reason why you don't want healthcare attached to employment. Look what happened during COVID. During a pandemic, millions lost their healthcare. It's actually the exact opposite of what you want to see happen during a pandemic, right? And because their healthcare was attached to their employment, they lost their healthcare. And now you're seeing the cases of folks that are surviving COVID with hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical debt. And so, you know, medical debt is the number one reason for family bankruptcies in our country, by far. And that's, by the way, after the establishment of the Affordable Care Act. It has not changed. Even with the Affordable Care Act, the ratio of bankruptcies, medical bankruptcies, has not changed. So yes, absolutely great that we had the Affordable Care Act to bring access, but it has not created true healthcare for everyone, because you're still seeing cost is dictating what kind of healthcare you have, whether you're rationing your medications, rationing other kinds of services. And by the way, you have insurance company. People say, oh, if the government's going to make the decision. Insurance companies right now are making the decision on what kind of care you get. They're overriding doctors and nurses, and they're the ones telling, you know, their customers, and doctors have to tell them too, when the insurance company says, no, we can't do this treatment that I'm telling you you need, to start a GoFundMe account. In the wealthiest state and the wealthiest nation on earth, it's unconscionable.
Yeah. I don't understand how it's not embarrassing for people. Like, I feel embarrassed. Like, this is ridiculous. Anybody who would ever say those things like, this is the greatest country in the world and we're all that and then some, it's like, yeah, no, we're really not. The fact that our bankruptcies are because of healthcare costs it's embarrassing. Like, I honestly, it is. Like, I don't understand how anybody could think we're all that.
You're going to hit a roadblock. You know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Where right now, is it going to be in the state Senate? Where do you see this becoming an issue? You know, Newsom is in a very unique position because clearly he wants to run for president. And if he is, I mean, look, if he were to pass single-payer health care, to become the first governor to pass single-payer health care in the United States, let me tell you something. He's already got a lot of charisma to begin with. There's a lot of things that you can say one way or the other about him, but that would be the it probably would be the ticket to the White House, to be honest. Where do you see things right now as far as where the roadblocks are going to come from, and what can we do to maybe mitigate that issue when it happens?
Well, I mean, we're far off from it being before the governor, although obviously the conversations would have to start in earnest well before that. Right now, we passed the Assembly Housing or Health Committee. It's up before the Appropriations Committee this coming week. And so every single time there's a vote needed, it's a roadblock, because, you know, that there's always an opportunity for the opposition to kind of really push back and internally, you know, get members to vote against it or not vote for it. And so every single step is a major milestone and a major hurdle. And so right now the process, we got through Health Committee. We have to go to appropriations. If it gets to appropriations, it'll be on the floor of the Assembly within 2 weeks. And it has to get off the Assembly floor before the end of the month. And it's because it's what's called a two-year bill. It was introduced last year. I held the bill in order to continue to work on the financing aspect, the constitutional amendment that I introduced that deals with constitutional issues as well as financing. But now that means that the policy bill, AB 1400, has to reach the has to pass the Assembly by the end of the month. Then it would go to the Senate, and then it would have a few months to make its way through the Senate before it ever had a chance of getting to the governor's desk. And so there's still a long way to go, but it is an accomplishment that we got past that first hurdle, you know, because I think it shows that we're working in earnest, that this is there's sincerity in the effort, and that we mean it. This is not for show. I'm not doing this for publicity. I'm doing this because I believe healthcare is a human right, and my goal as an elected official is to reduce suffering. And so I'm in a role where I can at least try to do it, and I wouldn't be able to sleep at night knowing that I didn't give it my best try.
Very wise words, and that really resonates with us. I mean, let's face it, we always say that universal healthcare makes total sense from a financial standpoint. It removes the for-profit middlemen in between you and your doctor. This is not, you know, this isn't communist China where, you know, you basically are not allowing doctors to make a living past a certain point. No, you're giving the economic freedom in a way that people I don't think are fully aware of. And I think that that's something that still needs to be, you know, kind of, I don't want to say taught, but it conveyed in a way that I think more people want to understand. I think one of the best arguments for universal health care in California alone is the fact that cost of living is so exponentially high. And if you were to have universal health care, the cost reduction for the average person would go down so much. It would probably affect their cost of living significantly, because a lot of people are leaving California for the fact that they just can't afford to live there. If you could talk about what type of financial impact that would make if they were to have a universal system.
Yeah, there's a lot of positive impacts. One is just a reduction of stress. You talk to people in other countries that, you know, they may have some complaints about their healthcare system, but they don't have to worry that they may end up homeless or they may end up bankrupt because of a health situation. A lot of stress that the working people, working families have, knowing they're one injury, one illness away from losing their home, or for complete catastrophe, is a fiscal catastrophe as a family. The other aspect of it in being attached to employment is that you can't have the freedom of choosing your job. A lot of people would leave their job if it wasn't, and you hear this all the time, I would leave my job, but I have good health care, so I don't want to leave it. You might have someone in an abusive relationship. There's so many different ways this manifests itself. And then, of course, the financial. Look, businesses pay $20,000 a year for an employee to have family health care, just in premiums. The average individual pays $6,000 a year. And so when folks, you know, think about, you know, and the news loves the word tax, like, right, oh, they're going to tax to pay for it. Well, we are already paying the highest health tax in the world. I'm trying to reduce it so that a payroll tax for an employer is 1.25%. Bye-bye 9.9% that you're paying for premiums right now.
Wow.
1% premium for the worker. So bye-bye to the 2.7% workers are paying on average between 50 and 100,000. They're paying 2.7% of their pay for healthcare. So bye-bye 2.7%. And by the way, no deductibles and no copays. So by way of example, if you make $55,000 a year, you don't pay payroll until the 50,000 is marginal. So that means you're paying 1% of the marginal rate. So that for $55,000 a year, right now you're probably spending $1,500 or more a year for healthcare. If your employer gives you healthcare, and keep in mind the operative word, they give you, because they don't have to, right? I mean, it depends on how many hours you work and what have you. But under the plan I put forward, they would pay $50 a year for healthcare. So $50 a year for healthcare through their payroll versus $1,500 plus for inadequate healthcare. The healthcare we're offering is better than Medicare. It's better than what, I mean, it's health, it's hearing, dental, vision, long-term care, no prescription costs. And how do we pay for it? Because it sounds like a dream. We pay for it by reducing the 20% administrative costs, which costs tens of billions of dollars a year to our system. Reduce that to single digits, the low single digits like Medicare and VA, because when you don't have 100 payers, the complexity goes down dramatically. And then also the profit taking and the fraud. Tons of, obviously, billions of profit taking. You reduce that and you're able to reduce the fraud because you don't have a complexity, a web of payment systems where fraud could be hidden.
Yeah. Why? Nobody's having to scam healthcare if they're given healthcare.
That's right.
It's really very basic. It's unbelievable.
It really just comes down to what type of a PR machine they're going to put forward if this thing continues to gain momentum. I am sure we see it all the time. You know, pharma, obviously, you know, companies like Pfizer, Moderna and whatnot.
And the insurance companies.
Yeah. You know, Aetna, Cigna, United, they will all take out massive multi-million dollar ad campaigns in the areas they need to convince the public that this is bad for them. This is actually communism, social, whatever they're going
to
say.
We're going to need to have Wendell Potter back on again. Anyway, yeah, I digress. You reminded me of that.
I just got connected with him. We're going to be talking later this week. So.
Oh, he's fantastic.
He's so excited to talk with him. And you know, the reality is they are going to spend hundreds of millions. Wendell will be, unsure, you know, he has that insight of what they're willing to do. And they're already starting. They're saying your taxes are going to be doubled. They're already saying you're going to lose your health care. All those things are already coming out. They already have a website. They're already doing social media. But they will spend hundreds of millions. So what I say to folks, especially when I introduce the ACA, they're like, oh, you want to go to the voters? They're going to spend all this money against you. Look, at the end of the day, it takes a movement. You know, and I think today is an appropriate day to talk about that on Dr. King's, you know, holiday. It takes a movement. And look, what they went through, what Dr. King and the Civil Rights Activists went through, you know, people died. They went through so much more than we have to go through. But we're going to have to take their energy and their spirit and recognize that we're going to be at the, we're going to have an army of people on the doors, knocking on doors. It's got to be like the, one of the greatest field campaigns that we've ever seen, because that's the only way we're going to get through to people is talking to them face to face. Otherwise, we're going to lose the battle of social media, the battle of TV ads, and the battle, frankly, of newspapers. I mean, the newspapers are corporate owned. They're going to, most of them are going to come out against it. Some are already writing articles against it. And then not to mention the mass media, TV and what have you. I mean, look, you know, when you have this corporate media that's going to be pushing against it. And that's why, especially when I talk to folks like you, I can actually have an open, honest conversation. When I do these news segments that are like these 1-2 minute news segments on the local news, the main focus is taxes. Oh, but you're going to raise taxes. You know, they don't talk about
Representative Calra. You know, the cost of living in California is already high enough to begin with. You want to add another tax on top of this? Right. How do you think we afford to live in the Bay Area, my friend?
Yeah, this is the problem.
And with that, we are done with the segment, and you don't have anything to say.
And the next three commercials are drug companies, right?
Well, that's the thing. It's like the same companies that don't want this or who signs those guys' paychecks on the media. So it's kind of like they're all the same people.
You also can't be afraid to basically throw it back at them and say, just remember, the companies that are putting these commercials out, they're the ones that are going to lose if we win. Yeah. This isn't a question of what you're not going to lose. You are going to win. It's these multinational corporations that have literally been, I always just the hammering home that statement of these are for-profit middlemen who provide no service whatsoever.
No, we pay them just to pay them.
They don't actually offer anything. And this is why it's tougher to build the Green New Deal movement, because there is a dependency on fossil fuel that is still here, even though we're trying to get off it. But there is that argument of, well, when you turn your lights on, where do you think that's coming from? As of right now, it's not coming from where it needs to come from. But this idea that we need Aetna and Cigna and, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield, we don't need them. They don't actually do anything to improve health outcomes.
It's just unbelievable.
So that argument, in the simplest terms, is just something that, you know, we need. And again, the progressive movement is very strong in California. So them really hammering that message home is obviously key. But it's not the full story. So I'm curious as to what your experience has been like talking with, let's say, conservative Democrats or even outright Republicans. What has been the response based on the conversations you've been having, not with the, you know, not with those invested in this, but with the voter who can ultimately help push this along?
You know, we're getting positive feedback. We're obviously getting folks saying, oh, you're raising our taxes, move back to Canada, whatever, you know, they'll say all that stuff. And it's a knee jerk. And the sad part is a lot of the folks with that knee jerk reaction would benefit greatly from this. Right. And we already see how the Republicans use emotion and fear to keep their base, you know, with them. And this is a perfect example. I mean, I think Republicans that I serve with are probably happy I introduced it, because they can go back to their districts and throw that red meat, like, oh, the Democrats are doubling your taxes, rather than having an actual honest conversation about the state of our healthcare. And we saw that during the health committee hearing, where my colleagues, straight out of like a script, went straight to, oh, you're going to double taxes. Oh, you're going to get rid of Medicare. Oh, this, that, and the other. And, you know, they're not well versed in the bill, nor do they need to be for their political purposes, right? And then it's just the Democrats that are more troubling, the ones that aren't that don't see it right away, how we have to push back against an industry that is killing people and is hurting our families. And you know, there's no doubt that it's not easy. I give a lot of credit and courage to the 11 Democrats that voted for my bill. It's not easy. It seems like a no-brainer on the policy side, but on the political side, the opposition makes it really hard for you to vote for these things. They have a lot of money. They can use it for you or against you. And so it does take courage. And that's why I tell folks to, when they reach out to my colleagues, to understand that, have some understanding that this is not easy for them, not because they don't necessarily believe in helping people, they do, but we've created a system that's so dependent and affected and impacted by money. And because we've done that, we have elected officials, some of whom are just going to politically take advantage of it, and some who are genuinely scared. And they're good people that need the cover. They need the protection of the people. You know, they need us, all of us, the movement, to wrap their arms around them and say, you know, you do this, we got your back. And if they come after you next election cycle, we've got your back. like, you know, we're going to make sure we push back. We'll be on the doors. We'll be your army to protect you for protecting us. And
yeah, that's the inside outside. That's what we always say. That's the outside supposed to be protecting the inside, not criticizing them to the point where they can't get anything done. Like, it's one thing to hold people accountable. It's another thing to just sort of, you know, have no clue as to that this is politics. And if somebody is on the inside, that is a specific type of game that that person needs to play to navigate that system. And it's just, it's like a Monday morning quarterback situation is what it always feels like.
And it also pushes folks the other way, right? They're like, well, you know, I these folks are so hostile. They're all over me. They're, you know, whether if I don't do 100% of what they want, they say I'm a traitor or you know, a capitalist or pro corporation. I did 9 of the 10 things, but that 10th thing I didn't do. And all of a sudden I'm like super evil. While the opposition, you do one thing that they want, they'll throw roses and champagne at you and wine and dine you. So, you know, it's a different mentality.
I hate to say it, but you sound exactly like a friend of ours, Andrew Yang, who was on our show not too long ago. And he said, you know, with the progressive movement, I could be right. What he said was, I could be right on 20 issues, but if I'm wrong on the 21st,
that's it.
That could be it for
me. You're done.
I'm
canceled.
Basically out. Done. And the progressive movement, this is sort of like this 5-year odyssey, as we talk about the whole Bernie Trump, you know, awakening for tens of millions of people. And the next evolution isn't necessarily, it's not compromising your values. It's recognizing that there is compromise in order to enact and forward the agenda. And that is something that I think is really lost on a lot of people. It is very difficult, especially in California, because California is one of the few states that actually pays a living wage to its assembly members. You know, it's a 6-figure salary in California. In Florida, forget it. It's a nightmare.
You can't.
You know, and the fact that it's in a completely inconvenient part of the state, it's not surprising that it's so corrupt, for being honest. We want to get to this point, but the only way we're going to get there is if we become a well-oiled machine. You know, we look at what the Tea Party was able to accomplish, not necessarily agreeing with what they were doing politically, but in terms of their cohesiveness, they didn't miss. Like, they were hell-bent on making sure that they got what they wanted. And the progressive movement really needs to recognize that you're not going to get everything that you want. So long as the people in question are not bought and paid for by corporate special interests, we know that you're not. And we know that there are many others like you that are trying to fight the good fight. Are there ones in the Assembly and the Senate that are bought by corporate interests? Absolutely. But we're working to change that. And the great thing about what we're fighting for, we don't need to be paid to fight for the cause. Whereas the people who are defending the crooked system that is preventing us from having these things, they're not doing it out of the kindness of their heart. They're doing it because they're getting paid to do it. And so the sooner more people realize that, the more the momentum is going to build. And anything that we can do, you know, look, that is obviously what we're here to do. And friend of the show, Kayla Estado, wants to know, how are the votes on the Appropriations Committee? So I guess, you know, where are we on the next step?
So I already met with the chair, Chair Holt. He's actually the brand new chair because Lorena Gonzalez just left the Assembly to become the next head of the California Labor Federation, which is fantastic, although I'm going to miss her dearly. She's such a fighter and so smart and strategic. That being said, I right away met with the chair. Kind of explain to him my approach, what's going on. We are talking to him as well as the Speaker's office on some amendments they like us to take, which we're totally fine with. So we're working on that language right now. When I look at the makeup of the committee, you know, it's pretty good. There's some of the same folks that were on the Health Committee are on it. Some of the co-authors of the bill are on it. And so, you know, I'm setting aside many hours over the next week or two to meet with my colleagues over Zoom or, you know, whatever it takes to talk it through. But I'll have a better sense, I think, in a day or two. The committee, I mean, it's on Thursday. So it's like, it's not like it's a 2-year bill in Assembly appropriate. So there's not a lot of time. And so either we get the momentum and push it through, you know, on Thursday, or we don't. And it's going to happen fast. And so, I mean, I go back tomorrow to Sacramento and literally within 48 hours, we'll know what's going to happen with the bill. And my 50th birthday is actually on Friday. So I'm hoping for a pretty good birthday gift.
Welcome.
Jen's 50 as well.
I turned 50 this year as well.
Why don't be sad? It's beautiful.
No, yeah. I know. It's welcome.
And
I don't know. You didn't sound convincing. You're like, no, no, no.
It's all good. Because he's like pointing at me. Yeah.
Ash, we can't thank you enough. Obviously, the work that you do, you know, I know that at times it probably feels, you know, futile and it's hard and all that comes with it. But we are huge supporters of you and what you're trying to do. It's going to take one major domino to fall. And whether it's New York or California, we think that our path, as it has been with a lot of other issues, whether it's marriage equality, as it is with cannabis, at the state level, this is where we are going, in my opinion. If we're going to do this, I think this is where it's going to happen. This is where it's going to break through. And we've got momentum here.
So I would canvas for that.
I absolutely would as well.
We
appreciate all that you do. Thank you. Obviously, if there's anything you want to plug before you go, please share. And we will definitely have you back again.
Well, I mean, there's one thing, that's AB 1400, like, you know, just everyone keep doing what you're doing. A lot of folks are reaching out to their legislators, to their assembly members, sharing on social media, getting the word out, talking to folks. Again, this is not going to happen because of one person, because of an assembly member or a governor or whatever it might be. It's going to happen because a movement pushes it forward and makes it happen. So
yeah, people, call your assembly members, leave messages. Mm-hmm. Do it. Just keep flooding them. Yeah, it does. Especially if your assembly member is on the appropriations committee or whatever the next step committee is.
Send emails, to call, phone calls. We tabulate it. We ask if the person lives in our district, if they're a constituent. And if so, we literally keep a tab when people call on bills. So if there's a bill coming up and my district director will be, hey, we're getting a lot of calls on this particular bill. And then I'll look more closely. Okay, what's the issue? You know, where are people standing on it? So it does matter. Yeah. It really does.
And one thing I can tell you guys, when they start getting like 10 dozen calls, they don't like it.
No.
At all.
They really don't.
So
the office people get really irritated.
This is how you get things done, quite frankly. You got to be a pain in the ass. Yep. And that's part of the game. And at the end of the day, we are very grateful for you, Ash. Keep fighting the good fight. We look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thanks,
brother.
Ash.
Thank you. Bye.
Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
I find it so like uplifting yet pitiful that it takes a Canadian to move here to try to help us get healthcare. Like, he's trying to show you the way, you know, and it's just...
Yeah, but we always like to blame Canada or blame Mexico. We're just so perfect here. Don't you know that?
Better
to bring on our podcast next to talk about how perfect America is and how we have no problems whatsoever. Oh, this is for you, Miss Kimberly. So, you know, Jen's getting the evening started.
I'm celebrating. Right, but does it make any difference that this is a Bob Marley fight?
Get together and feel all right.
It was actually, what's so funny is it was the only glass pipe. And I'm like, oh, Bob Marley, that's cool.
She is an author and activist and one of the greatest truth tellers you will ever see. Friend of the show, Margaret Kimberly. Welcome back to Generational Change.
Hi. Hi there. Good to see you.
Good to see you. You look lovely. Well,
I was just going to say, you look lovely.
You look lovely.
Thank you very much. I don't go on camera without makeup.
And he doesn't understand that. Like, he'll just be ready to sit down and go. And I'm 50 and it just doesn't work that way. And it's just, he's like, can you do a quick video? I'm like, I just got up. Can you just throw a video together? I'm like, oh yeah. Yeah,
look, I have said many a times before, it is so much easier to be a guy than it is to be a lady. So I'm
just saying. So I appreciate
what you ladies, have to go through on a daily basis. Us guys should be very grateful that you don't want to kill us.
And it gets worse.
Or maybe you do, and you just don't.
We're fine with or without you, to be honest. Like, we're kind of good either way.
Fair thee warned. So let's start with the wonderful Senator Sinema saying what a hero Dr. King is for her, wearing the cross now on the Senate floor. I mean, it's like the transformation is slowly but surely happening, but I'm just waiting for the midterms where she announces, I am officially a member of the GOP now. But it's so...
She doesn't support the voting rights legislation.
Yeah,
but Dr. King is her idol.
It's like what we really want to talk about from your perspective is how everybody's virtue signaling today, And it's almost like they're missing the entire point of what this man stood for. It's so easy to virtue signal, but to actually get to the crux of what he's fighting for, and most of what he's fought for, is still not in place. So where are we today, and what did you observe today, aside from the obvious pandering that so many like to do?
Do you see any of that nonsense?
Of course.
Well, my favorite was a tweet from a Republican saying that Dr. King would have opposed critical race theory. That was my favorite thing today. But it's interesting. Of course, it's right and appropriate to honor Dr. King. But every year, the scoundrels come out and use his name. A year to the day before he was assassinated, he gave a speech at Riverside Church in which he opposed the Vietnam War. And yet these members of Congress who vote for big defense spending and interfering with other countries, they all show up at a King Day. Everybody shows up at a King Day event. So then it's lost its meaning if everybody is allowed to try to take some part of his legacy. A part of me thinks that it might be better if his birthday were not an official holiday, because it just brings out the worst in people. There's sales and King Day sale, or people who are who promote racist policies or who advocate for war suddenly wanting to wear his mantle. And it just cheapens everything that he stood for, that the movement that preceded him and helped to develop him as a minister and as a leader, his influence all over the world. I was just in Managua, Nicaragua last week, and there's a Martin Luther King Avenue there where they honor heroes from throughout the world. So I think it's important to pay less attention to this official celebration, because it just becomes a joke, and it's not something that he deserves, and it's not something that educates us.
So I was watching on your show, for anybody, would you put it, so it's a Black Agenda Report, which is a really good program. So it's just that way there's a point of reference. But
yes.
So I was watching, and I cannot remember the gentleman's name, but he was with the Black Liberation Movement. He was like old school, talking about like crazy things like socialism and Leninism and crazy things. Woo! And really, to me, when I think of Dr. King, I think more like that, and this idea of the Poor People's Campaign and the idea of labor. And nobody really talks about that. And yet to me, that's what was the most unfulfilled. Like, that was the next step. Like, that's where we needed to keep going.
Because the second you mess with rich people's money, that's it, you're done.
But I mean, can you talk a little bit about that? Because like, I know it, but not everybody understands. Like, this was somebody who was not a capitalist. This was somebody that really believed in like a whole poor people's movement. And I just thought, we never talk about that. We only talk about the civil rights stuff.
Again.
And which, not that that's not important, but I think we need to see this more as an economic situation. Your thoughts?
Well, Frank Chapman is the man you're referring to.
Thank you.
Who was in Chicago. And you're absolutely right. Towards the last couple of years of his life, the Civil Rights Act had been passed, the Voting Rights Act had been passed, and this major legislation had gotten done as a result of the mass movement. And he was thinking more about economic issues. He was talking about things that made people very uncomfortable. He was talking about segregation in the North. He was talking about segregation in Chicago, where he was attacked by a mob, and he said they were worse than a mob in Mississippi, when he started talking about housing integration and school desegregation. The Poor People's campaign was something that he was working on very seriously towards the end of his life, speaking out against the war, speaking out against militarism. And the military budget was a fraction of what it is now, where it's 60% of all discretionary spending. So speaking of things that he did not get to accomplish. So it's important for us to know the whole man. You know, if you read, if you watch the news on his birthday, you think he gave one speech, the I Have a Dream speech, which actually was the least substantive of everything that he ever said. And without any mention of what he said about economic inequality, what he said about imperialism, that is, we have to remember the whole man. It's, and there's no point in having this King Day if we're going to cherry pick the things that can make people the most comfortable now. He wasn't worried about making people uncomfortable. No. And he was, you know, and he was, in general, very unpopular at the end of his life. He was, of course, always loved in the Black community, but opinion polls showed him with some very high negatives because he had made people uncomfortable. But that's what we have to remember. And that's what we all, if we're going to claim to respect him and honor him, have to do ourselves.
Hats off to Bernie for putting out probably the best tweet today regarding his, you know, Dr. King's day, is the fact that he was assassinated in Memphis while marching with the striking sanitation workers who were being treated abhorrently. And what's interesting, of course, is the fact that there's always the virtue signalers who want to jump on there and basically trash Bernie for having that as his message, rather than like all the other things that people, I guess, like want to talk about. But the truth is, everything always comes back to economic justice for those who don't have any power. And that is the great dividing issue of our time. Corporate special interests is what dominates our government everywhere. And if we're going to talk about Dr. King's message, we have to talk about the message that, like you said, seems to be ignored every single year. And if we're going to talk about what's really the crux of why he was killed, it's because he was trying to bring everybody in the working class together. And when that happens, you know, well.
He'd be fighting for all the labor stuff now.
He was. The sanitation workers in Memphis, as you said, were very poorly paid, poorly treated. They had to, if it was one of them, the strike began when a man was crushed. He was sleeping in the truck. And this anger had been building, and they asked Dr. King to come and support their actions. And, you know, a couple of days, he spent several days in Memphis. And there was a near riot, dare I use the word, and he got negative press for that. King is fomenting violence among sanitation workers in Memphis. So, but that is something very important. And he, you know, he gave his Vietnam speech literally a year to the day, April 4th, 1967. And that last year of his life was one that was very, very difficult for him because he made the wrong people uncomfortable. So Lyndon Johnson was very angry that he spoke against the Vietnam War. And actually, the New York Times criticized him. Some of his own people said, let's not make Lyndon Johnson angry. He's helped us out. So you don't want to, you know, you don't want to piss him off. And you're absolutely right. When you start talking about opposing capitalism, these are things that make enemies. So, you know, to answer, you haven't asked about it, but no, I don't trust the official story that this James Earl Ray guy, you know, who was a petty criminal who, never committed a crime that he wasn't arrested for within a few hours, that he decided to travel all over the country and track King and decide to shoot him. I you know, managed to have two passports and got to London. It was crazy. No, I don't believe that story.
Yeah, King's family doesn't believe that story.
No, of course they don't. Yeah. And I'm very happy that they spoke what anybody with common sense already knew, that this you know, this story doesn't hold water, doesn't make sense at all. They're very powerful people who wanted King dead. And they succeeded in killing him at the moment when he began to change his message to one that really threatened the system.
Yeah. Something that I find interesting when you talk about like all the bad press he was getting at the time, mm-hmm. and he was getting that from just mainstream mm-hmm. papers. It wasn't like, you know, the people that are now standing there singing his praises now would have been the same people that would have been opposing him then. 100%. Even Democrats, same party, same thing. They would be saying things like, you know, there's a better way to do this. You're really causing a ruckus. You know, you really got to do it. So all the same people that are singing his praises would have been the same people that would have been opposed to him at the time. And I just, it's like, I kind
Joe, Joe Biden.
I just feel like I'm watching it almost in slow mo, like where I can see that you're saying this, but you would have been totally supportive of that New York Times article. Like you would have been like, yeah, that's right. You know, so even so-called liberals. Right. So I just think it's really interesting that it's like, now it's safe to really be, a fan because he's not threatening your income anymore. He's not threatening your status.
Margaret, if you could have a little fun with why liberals, especially comfortable liberals, love to virtue signal. What is it about them that makes them just they're so.
Well, no, but if he were alive. They would not be doing that. They'd be scared of him. Like they would not be doing that. If he were still alive and stayed on the trajectory, he wouldn't be popular amongst those people today.
No. Well, you know, if you virtue signal, you don't have to do anything. Right. You could just pat yourself on the back, consider yourself superior, look down your nose at other people, but you never have to take any action. You don't have to think about the role you might play in processes that are unjust. And you'd have to, I mean, God forbid, you'd have to think about what you do and how you should change the system. So it's the easiest thing in the world just to consider oneself a superior being and to think that you live in this bubble of great intelligence and superiority. So I think that's the problem. But you know, King talked about the white moderate, and he wrote the letter from the Birmingham jail, and all the people who said, "Well, now's not the time," or "This isn't the day to demonstrate," or those people. They're still doing that, by the way. Some of the
Didn't Hillary just say that?
Yeah.
Like, did she just not say that quote? Which I honestly cannot think of something. More in like it's like
I mean, we know that she's disconnected.
It's an
from
irony
reality,
of an but. Irony of an irony. Like I can't even think of anything more funny than that. Well,
She Hillary Clinton. What can we say? She won't die, go away, or be quiet. So for her to try. I mean, and what a horrible example. This terrible person who's laughed about making war in Libya and killing the president who. Is actually very conservative. If you remember when Bill Clinton ran for president, she bragged about being a Goldwater girl in an effort to get conservatives to vote for her, who's, talked about bringing to heel
predators.
Yeah, she's so of course she would say that and not get the irony. She's the most tone deaf politics. I mean, it's why she lost the presidency, frankly, to Trump. But she's trying to come back. She and Bill are trying to put their names out there again.
It's never going to happen, Hillary. Never. No, she's just so bitter. But it's the idea of her making any sort of comment about the white liberal or the white moderate. It's
I mean,
just
all she
hilarious.
Had to do, if she wanted to, I mean, everybody, right, has got to get in on King. She could have said injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Something nice and something plain vanilla and, it would have been okay. But no. She's got to pick something that's pointing directly at her, something that indicts her and her entire, and her husband and their entire political careers. But that's Hillary now. She's.
It always spoke to who she is as a person because whenever she talks about something, it's always about her. It's always about me and what I want. And it's this. It's this whole I'm better than you.
She's the dark triad of personality.
Yeah,
she is. It's narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy is the dark triad. And I cannot think of anybody who fits that more than her.
Well, remember her campaign slogan was "I'm with her," not "I'm with you,"
right?
Or "I'm for you." It's like it was still about.
It's still about her.
Yeah,
and it's tone deaf anyway.
Well, that is the embodiment of, you know, that liberal side of condescension and air of superiority. And the sad truth is that there are tens of millions of people who embrace it and embody it. No worse. I would say what was so interesting is that the best and worst thing that could have happened during the Trump presidency basically happened at the same time. He axed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's probably the one signature thing he did as president that I absolutely 1,000% support. But at the same time, you had a million mostly white suburbanite housewives marching with their pink hats on in D.C. And all I'm thinking is, you're basically here right now on your own dime marching because you hate this president. And I'm thinking, what if a million of you who actually have influence, you have means.
March for healthcare.
March for the environment. Why the hell are you not out there doing that?
Because they were able to make money on pink vagina hats.
Absolutely. It was, you know, I think it's we've been talking about January 6th. And one of the things I thought last year was, why is it the right wing that'll march on the Capitol? And I'm not suggesting that the left do exactly what they did. Right. But to mobilize for anything. I mean, it was all about their feelings being hurt. Yes. And then when a Democrat comes into office and does what Trump does, you don't hear a peep out of them.
It's even worse because they brush out. A corporate media is so in the bag for him, but they're really just, again, the problem is that the two biggest media centers in politics are D.C. and in New York, and 90 to 95% of them are Democrats. You're not allowed to have any other thought other than what is in the corporate interests of the neoliberal establishment. Everything. Paul Paglia opens his effing mouth today saying that we don't have bad leaders in the Democratic Party. We have bad followers.
This is why people are leaving.
Just pull off the mask already.
Didn't they learn from the deplorables comment? Like, they really don't learn. It's the same comment.
I know. Well, you know, the Democratic quote unquote leadership, these are people who get into politics to make money. All the people who left worked for Obama. Now they've got cushy jobs in media or in corporations or with big tech. That's what they do. Simone Sanders, who worked for Kamala Harris. It's funny. People usually wait at least a year to jump ship. But now where's she going? To MSNBC.
Getting her own TV show.
Yes, of course. So they do. They cover for the Democrats. You know, it's like with COVID. Biden's response to COVID has been an absolute disaster. I would argue worse than Trump's. But they cover up for him. And it's not going to help, actually. I think people are just going to stay away. A lot of the people he needs to come out this November are just not going to. But they collude, collusion, right? That's still a big word, right? Collusion between the Democratic Party and corporate media and big tech is all used to gaslight us. So Joe Biden, for example, has granted more oil and gas drilling permits on public land than Trump did.
And that's in 1 year.
Yes.
And so it doesn't matter. So Trump withdraws from the latest climate accord and, you know, Democrats go back in. Hooray, Democrats are back in the climate accord. But then if you give more drilling permits, well, what was the point of that? The point was PR. It was all to look better. And defense spending, the thing that makes me the angriest, it never gets any better. Even when Trump was president, Democrats gave him more than he asked for in his last NDAA bill.
Margaret, I just want to ask you, can we, I decided that I'm not calling it the Defense Department or the defense bill, it's the offense. This is an offense budget. There's nothing defensive about it at this point. And let me tell you something else. I find it quite offensive. So to me, it's just like, this is the Department of Offense. We haven't been on defense, I don't think, since Pearl Harbor. And this is It's ludicrous. And the same thing that you're saying about him with the environment, I find him like this thing with Afghanistan. Okay, so he had the gumption to get out of Afghanistan, but now he's creating like a million dead children through the sanctions and killing the people of Afghanistan just so that he could look politically proper and not look like he's supporting the Taliban. Like, so it's, and nobody's really talking
and
about
this
that.
This is the greatest sin of corporate
They're
media.
Going to kill more people. He is going to be responsible for killing more That's people true. Through these sanctions than in the entire 20 years of this
You know,
war.
It's like, I have to say, you know, in foreign policy, Biden has the worst, most incompetent team. It was leaving Afghanistan was the right thing to do, but they didn't know how to do it. They were either they didn't know or lied to the rest of us about Afghanistan has a, you know, 300,000 man army. They didn't have an army. They collapsed like a cheap lawn chair. And the Biden administration didn't even have a plan for securing an airport. And then a drone strike, which killed a family and not the terrorists we were told it was killing. Now they've decided to kill more people. With sanctions against the country. So this is, I can't imagine how Trump could have done any worse than this. But the media, again, cover up for him. And if their goal is to help Democrats get elected, they certainly aren't going about it in the right way. That's why it's so important for folks like yourself and us to be able to use these outlets as much as we can to get some different point of view across to the public, because what the media do is just lie. And I want to say quickly before I go, I'm very much worried about Ukraine. There's no Russian plan to invade Ukraine. There's a U.S. plan to try to get the Ukrainians to attack the autonomous republics and try to drag Russia into a war, all of which is extremely dangerous and threatens nuclear war. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that.
Yeah, but you know, like before you go, let me just say that I think that today on any day, like especially today, we should say, what would Dr. King do about Afghanistan children? You know, like where people, if you're going to sit there and virtue signal about this, be aware that these issues are going on. Just that's sort of my point.
Oh, sure he would. He would say, don't starve the children out of Afghanistan.
Exactly.
He would have been saying for the past 20 years, there was no reason to be in Afghanistan. So he would have been, he called him, he gave a speech. He wanted to be a drum major for justice. So he would have been speaking out against all of these travesties that we're talking about tonight.
Yeah,
I was speaking with a friend the other day who's very conservative, very pro-military, and talks about, you know, how bad ISIS is. And I'm like, I'm not defending ISIS. ISIS is bad. But how do you think ISIS was created? You know, one of the things that nobody talks about with the way, listen, it's great, obviously, to bring the troops home, but if you look at how the troops were brought home in the circumstances that it was almost done deliberately to create a vacuum. So that way another ISIS type terrorist organization cell could form from the way that we did this. It's like, do you guys like not?
It gives all the contractors things to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, the U.S. is, I mean, it all started in Afghanistan, the U.S. Supplying and paying these jihadist proxies. So the Taliban were on America's side. Remember, the Soviets were had been invited in by the Afghanistan government, but we were told they invaded, and these were people who, you know, were going to, they were equivalent of the founding fathers. I remember Reagan saying something along those lines.
Well,
so
I,
the
may
US,
it, I don't remember or not, I can't tell you.
So bin Laden was America's guy. He was one of the people that the U.S. was using, the ISIS in Libya, in Syria, were used to help topple or an attempt to topple a government in Syria. It's actually Russia that defeated, and the Iran who defeated ISIS in Syria. That's the simple fact of the matter. But yes, all of these groups are created by the U.S. And you said something about the Defense Department. We should just call it the War Department. That's what it was called.
That's fine.
During the war.
That's
it was the War Department.
The
it
war
was
Department.
Truth in Advertising, but they get billions of dollars to make sure that there's a war somewhere. And guess what? We always get a war.
Yeah, the war budget. That's exactly what it is.
Do you think there's going to be a breaking point? Right now, we're seeing just so many things all coming together. And let's be honest, it's President Blinken, not President Biden. I like to say that often. But when we think about, you're not getting, and again, obviously, we could talk about voting rights, we could talk about all those things. But at the end of the day, economically speaking, we're getting nothing, literally nothing. And all anybody wants to do is point the finger at Manchin and Sinema. Biden has done nothing. When I mean nothing, he has done less than nothing. He hasn't even pretended by calling a, you know, he could address the nation, sit down and talk about the importance of the Build Back Better bill and why this is actually going to help working families. He didn't do that.
Nope.
And this idea that
he could pay off, he could have paid done with student loans. That would change everybody's
and
life.
And he could do it. And there's things he could do without Congress.
Of course. No, he's done none of it.
He could take on all of these issues. And as far as Manchin and Sinema, you know, I feel like it's bad drama. They're like the bad cops and everybody gets to point to them. And they, you know, I feel like they drew straws and came up with the short ones. It's like they get to be the bad guys when there are many Democrats who are in support of what they want. Democrats are, what did he tell the big fundraisers? Nothing will fundamentally change. And these are the people who fund all the campaigns. These are the people who run our politics. So they don't want to give an inch, even to help the Democrats to say, you know, could you let us give people one little thing over here? Nope. $1 trillion in student loan debt, minimum wage not going up. They made a big deal about he's cutting child poverty in half. The child tax credit's over. It's gone. They kicked people off of unemployment. The so-called progressives cover for him. I give him an A. He's exceeded expectations. Oh,
when Pramila did that, oh my Lord. And again, the thing that I like to bring up is that this has basically been a six-year odyssey now. With the whole Bernie Trump phenomenon. And for a lot of people, it's this political awakening that they've never really had before. And they're getting their sea legs now in regards to how the sausage is made. And once the populace recognizes the game for what it is, you're not going to fool them anymore. It's one of those things where it's going to the populace is going to overrun the establishment.
Here's hoping.
It's just a question of when it's going to happen and how it's going to happen. But as one of our favorites, JFK, said, if you make peaceful revolution impossible, violent revolution is inevitable. And I'm wondering, how much longer do you think you can squeeze desperate people tightly before they revolt? Because we're kind of in that phase right now, wouldn't you say?
It's like there's always something that happens, and I'm thinking this is the tipping point. This is
right.
It's all going to blow. But we're seeing it in, you know, the unionization efforts in Starbucks or Amazon, or even people robbing Amazon trains. It was such a bizarre story. I was like, what do you mean they're robbing Amazon trains? But we're seeing some of it in bits and pieces. Unfortunately, there's not a coherent movement. We need a general strike, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
I thought COVID would do it. You know, COVID is bad in this country because we don't have the infrastructure that cares for people. It didn't have to be this bad ever. And it was easy to blame Trump, and he's going there. Now they're going to try, you know, keep trying to ride the Trump horse. But so I don't know. I have to be honest. I don't know what will finally be the tipping point that will create the mass movement that we need. I do worry, you know, something else could happen. We could just have a society that begins to devolve and devolve and devolve further. The cataclysm doesn't have to be the thing that sparks change, doesn't have to be something positive. So I think it's important for us to get out in front and make sure that when people say I've had enough, it's in a way that's useful and productive and helps.
I think it could be with a climate catastrophe. I think that it could be something like everything south of Lake Okeechobee is flooding and underwater, and you've got 100 million people from Florida that are now like having to, we are so ripe for something to just basically be the end of at least a chunk of people. Like, and I think that we're just like, it's like Russian roulette for us every year with hurricane season. It's like Russian roulette is what I feel like.
Yeah. And we're also, that's the thing that people still don't understand about why Trump is so popular. It's not that people think he's great. It's that they hate him less than they hate the corporate establishment on Capitol Hill. And that is the thing that I think people still can't get their heads around. It's like, oh, Trump is so crass and this and that. Well, at least Trump is saying something that they like to hear. You guys don't even want to pay lip service. And even when you do, as soon as you get power, you completely disregard it because we know that you guys are owned by corporate interests. And that is kind of just getting that message out there and continuing to hammer away at it. The economic message is what got Dr. King killed. That more than anything else, once you start trying to rally the masses instead of playing this divide and conquer strategy, and that's not to say we don't have racist issues, sexist issues, misogynistic issues. All these things are in a capitalist system. When you're trying to climb the ladder, there's always going to be things that people are going to use to distract you. But if the people ever figured out a way to unite, I mean, I don't labor. I don't know what it, well, yeah, the labor movement that's, is what we talk
I, and
about.
I think that's a big part of where we're going to see it. And I think that it will eventually spread. And that's what, you know, but, and I love the idea of a general strike. And what we should be talking about is the infrastructure that needs to be put into place so that that can happen. Because that's something that, you know, that's...
If the next progressive who catches fire that is going to run for president in 24 starts talking about a general strike, then we'll really see just how...
But you have to have ducks in a row. Like, you have to have ducks in a row. And that's the problem, is we don't have that. And the idea of having that on a national level just seems so untenable. Whereas I know, like, for example, in Alabama, we had one of the coal miners on that was on strike, and they have a really tight network of support, and they're able to sustain a strike. They're able to withstand it in a lot of the older, like the communities that are like, you know, the mining communities versus the Amazon workers. The Amazon workers don't have like generations in this town where they're like part of that for life, where they have this sort of like camaraderie. And Amazon and companies like that do that on purpose. People are transient there and come and go for a reason so that they don't really have an opportunity to build camaraderie. And that's a big part of the problem, I think.
And I think we just need, you know, political education. I don't know how many Americans know about what a general strike is or would be if they know the term at all. So there's a lot of very basic information to get out, but it can be done. It's been done before. We were talking about the liberation movement of the 50s and the 60s. There were people who, you know, did not know anything about politics or mass action, but they did it. They figured it out. So I believe it can happen. It can happen again, and it has to happen. I also think the thing that could be a tipping point is a war. I really do. That is something that people are not prepared for. I mean, they're trying to propagandize us into, you know, thinking we have to contain China or attack Russia. But if there's an actual shooting war, I think you would see a lot of opposition to it. I'm not trying to wish war upon the world, but I think that's something that could spark a mass movement that could do good things.
Yeah. My mom always says she's waiting for the revolution. And I feel like that, but you know, why aren't the fact that we drone bomb, however many countries we're drone bombing, like, why isn't that outrageous enough? Because it doesn't get covered. So I always wonder, so let's say we have a war in Crimea, or let's say something happens. It will be covered how we're told it's covered. Like, I wonder how much we would actually know. Like, how hard would even know? There's no more foreign correspondence for any of the mainstream media. They're all just told talking points from whoever is in charge at the White House. And that's what they know. There are no more, like, there's your Abby Martins of the world. There's people that are out there doing that, but not enough people see those people.
No. I think Vietnam, I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War. I was a little kid. But and that's also when they decided they were not going to allow journalists to roam around freely and report what they wanted and possibly engender negativity among the public. So people are embedded, if they send anybody at all, But I think there is something about a U.S. starting being in a war with China or Russia that I think would at very least scare most people. And it would be difficult to make the case, especially with all the other things that we've been talking about, the insecurity that people feel, the low wage work and the student loans and the COVID, which goes on and on and on. I think it might be different. And, you know, all the covering up in the world would not sustain support for something like that.
Well, we are running out of time as far as I can see, because things just seem to be getting worse and worse and worse. But they say that the night is darkest just before the dawn. And maybe we are on the cusp of something much better than where we are right now. It's just a question of what that's going to look like.
Right.
It's, again, we look at the political spectrum, you know, we look at how things are down here. Billy Corbin, who's a filmmaker down here in South Florida, said, so goes Florida, so goes the country. It's like the Florida of today is America of tomorrow. I sure hope that isn't
the
truth.
You should be very scared, people. You should be very, very scared.
Well, you don't like DeSantis?
And you know what? I actually believe that there's a good chance that that's our next president.
Yeah, I do.
So he could win. He absolutely could win. They, you know, COVID is funny. People, there's a great divide about it. So, you know, the pink hat crowd will sneer at DeSantis, but there are millions of people who resent the vaccine mandates.
Yes.
The benefits of vaccines have not been explained well enough. It's very simple. It keeps you out of the hospital. I don't know how to do that, but I think those there are enough people, and now he's being touted as, what is it? We're free people or free state or something like that. But so yes, to make a long story short, yes, he could be president. I have no idea. I'm not going to make predictions about who the president could be. It's not going to be Joe Biden. It's not going to be Kamala Harris. That's for sure.
And it's not going to be Pete Buttigieg.
Oh no.
I don't know. But, you know, the thing about DeSantis that people do like, it's also something that a lot of people like about Trump. It's that they're taking a stand and they're going to speak their mind and they're not playing games and they're not kind of, you know, taking the knee. And I think that people respect that, even if it's very misguided in a lot of cases. And the thing about DeSantis, and Florida is a red state. It is. And it is a very county strong state, and it is a very pro civil liberty state. And when you start, this isn't, as people think it's blue because they hear from all the people in Dade and Broward and they think, no, this is rural, it's red. And when you start talking about forcing people to do stuff, they're not having it. They're just not having it.
I don't think the Democrats in the state have any idea what's coming in November. I think they really, it's going to be really bad.
And I would like to also say that even in the urban areas, a huge portion of the Black community is not having any of that. And with a lot of real, you know, suspicion built into history and reason for feeling that way, it's real. Like, they're not going to have a mandate, you know?
Yeah. I noticed something interesting about DeSantis, and something I find annoying. He has this hayseed routine. He talks about the elites. Now, he's a double Ivy Leaguer. You know, as a governor of a law, I'm like, what, dude, what are you talking about? You're the elite. You're talking about yourself. But he does. And last week he made some reference to the ruling class. The ruling classes are, want these restrictions. And I was like, wait a minute. When have we last heard a Democrat talk about the ruling class? How does he get to steal? I mean, they're the putative left party. So how is he the one talking about a ruling class? And the Democrats, of course, don't offer any ideology, really. It's virtue signaling about certain issues, as we've discussed. But at the end of the day, they end up siding with the oligarchy. And yes, we have an oligarchy here. It's my new favorite word. With the oligarchy over the people all the time. So someone like DeSantis, who has his finger on that part of the pulse. Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. He could be president.
And he's much more palatable than Trump is.
He is. And he's also extremely politically savvy. Yeah. He's extremely
smart. He's got a great team around
him. Like whoever he is, he's making smart. I mean, you know, it's scary. But again, we had Rick Scott for 8 years. See, that's the thing. Like, our lowest low is you can't even fathom. So DeSantis is a step up for us.
And that's why whatever the progressive movement is going to evolve past Bernie now and how that's going to look. You could learn a lot from the way that somebody like DeSantis, yes, even Trump, conducts themselves, because the truth is they rally the masses, but they're what I like to call the false prophets. They are not actually working on behalf of the working class agenda. No. But somebody who could take their, you know, no BS attitude, because people love that.
Yes.
They love that. Yes. They love somebody who's saying, I'm going to kick ass and take names. And that has always worked in politics. It worked for LBJ. It worked for Reagan. It even worked for numbnuts Bush. You know, it's like at some point.
Well, I, you know, I think you are. I agree. I do. I think you are right about that. There's something of people appreciate someone who's fear. I remember there was a, which New York mayor was it? I hate. Oh, Ed Koch. And someone said, you know, I like Koch because he's fearless. And I think that's true about the appeal that politicians can have. But we're, you know, things are, it's an interesting time, right? It's
right. So you feel like you're watching it unfold almost in slow-mo, but what are you working on now? Like, what, I mean, I know you've Black Agenda Report, but you usually have other things brewing.
Well, I've become, as I think I mentioned briefly, I just returned from Nicaragua. That's my second trip in a few months. It's been interesting to see a country which is has a revolutionary government and which the public are in favor of. And it's funny to me because nobody thought about Nicaragua for a long time. And then Biden's like, we got to sanction Nicaragua. They can't elect Ortega again. Now, this is a small country, 6 million people. There are more people in New York City. But the United States decides to drop the hammer on this country and sanction them because how dare you elect a leftist government? And I think we have to have an internationalist viewpoint. You're not going to have justice at home and injustice in the rest of the world. We have to advocate to have a just government for the whole planet. So we have to oppose these efforts to interfere with other countries. And as soon as the U.S. imposed sanctions on Nicaragua, what did they do? They established relations with the People's Republic of China, which is their right to do. So these efforts, which I think are wrong to begin with, are also short-sighted. And we have many countries now engaged in efforts to protect themselves from the United States. So Russia and China are very close. A little country like Nicaragua is attacked by the U.S. So they begin to sign agreements with China. And so I think it's important for Americans to know more about the rest of the world. I think people who consider themselves leftists must always oppose U.S. interventions. I think that is very, very important. More so than scrutinizing another country necessarily. So that's something I'm very much interested in. I was with a delegation from with the Black Alliance for Peace. So that's something that's taking up a lot of my thought now. I'm since Glenn Ford passed away, the executive editor of Black Agenda Report. I'm now the executive editor, so it's taking a lot of my time, but we've got a great team. Wednesday is Black Agenda Report Day, blackagendareport.com. This Wednesday, our issue is devoted to analyzing the first year of the Biden administration. So I hope that people take a look at that, but pay attention to what's happening in the rest of the world. You cannot learn anything reading the New York Times or the Washington Post or watching CNN or MSNBC. You can follow us. You can, there are other great people doing great stuff on these issues, and you need to pay attention to them. And I think it, when it comes to foreign policy, it's fair to say whatever the State Department spokesperson tells you is not true. So I think you can't go wrong if you just make that assumption. And Biden's team, foreign policy people are really, really uniquely bad. And so I worry about what they're going to do in the rest of the world. We should always be fighting to cut the military budget, to close these military bases, to let other people in the rest of the world have their right, the right to choose the governments that they want. And not being an empire is a much better deal for people in this country than to have a government which thinks it ought to run the world and make people suffer. So those are some of the things on my mind these days.
You are
just small things like that. Yeah. Just small things like American imperialism and the and death of humanity.
And the climate, well, that's all. It's
just, you know, small things. Yeah, I always say that too. You cannot expect to have peace here if you're wreaking havoc all around the world. So when people, when something really violent happens here, a horrible shooting, a horrible, whatever it is, and people are so shocked by this. And I'm like, no, how do you think that works? We're violent people. We're a violent nation, and violence begets violence, and you cannot have it both ways. So,
and I wanted to say one more thing. You talked about the progressive running in 2024. We know what the Democratic Party does to progressives.
Yeah,
I think people have to really stop supporting the Democrats, because we saw what they did to Bernie not once, and I believe put Trump into office. If Bernie had been the nominee, he would have beaten Trump. I'm certain of it. And also what they did propping up Biden, who nobody really wanted, let's be honest. I think we have to look outside of the duopoly. We can't allow ourselves to be browbeaten into supporting the Democrats. We've got to have a progressive who's really willing to wage an independent progressive campaign, because I think that can be a winner.
We do too.
I would say the one person who would be willing to do it outside the party at this moment in time, if he's up to the task, would be Jesse Ventura. But we will
Jesse, come on the show for 420.
Yeah, that would be that would be unbelievable. I will see what I can do, Jen. And I will keep
it. I love me some Jesse Ventura.
Margaret, we can't thank you enough. You are a delight as always. Guys, the Black Agenda Report, please check it out.
Yeah.
Fantastic work as always.
For sure.
And we hopefully will see you again.
Yeah. And always let us know if you have anything new you want to talk about.
Absolutely. Sure thing. Thank you.
Thanks, Margaret.
It's good to see you guys.
Bye-bye.
Good night, pal. Bye-bye.
I love
one of the best.
I love her.
One of the best.
She's always lovely.
And always speaking the truth, which again is something that, you know,
and yet it's very pleasantly. Like that's the thing that's so cool. She's calm, pleasant demeanor, speaking hard truths, as opposed to angry, ranting lunatic. Like it's so much more effective when you hear it as this is just the way it is.
You hear that FHL? Just throwing that out there.
Well, I'm just like, it's much more effective. And yeah, I mean, I don't want to talk about those people.
I think that when we learn about what it actually takes to build the coalition, Ms. Kimberly is obviously somebody who knows what that takes. And you have to consider the fact that the current state of the duopoly, especially within the Democratic Party, especially with superdelegates.
Mom, people won't know you're being sarcastic.
Yeah.
That's my mom. She does not really think we should control the universe.
But I do think that speaks to the great issue here, which is, you know, what is it going to take to really wake up the masses? It's so very difficult to get people to agree on anything. So unfortunately, we are stuck in this.
I found a couple of good stories, though. Did you see that?
Yes.
I found a couple of like positive stories. So we'll do a focus on Florida.
This is interesting where our little shot goes now, because we're like very
well, because I changed it. You can go to this one if you want.
This one?
Yeah, if you want. Or no, that one.
That one?
That one, yeah.
Okay, that works.
I don't know. I was kind of messing with it, you know, crazy.
All right, so
what do you want to start with?
We start left to right.
And do you always do it? Because now that I know that, I'll have to design it that way. I just sort of put
You know, we talk about all the time what the after effects are of people like Debbie Wasserman Schultz not paying the ultimate political price for what she did to not only kneecap Bernie, but to more or less ensure that Trump became president.
I know. I was almost on the verge of when Margaret said that, like, that was the reason that we have Trump is because of what the Democrats did to Bernie. And a big part of that was Hillary and Debbie. I mean, that was the whole point.
So when you do not take the necessary action to deal with the cheating, the illicit behavior that goes on in politics when it becomes front and center and people are now losing faith in the electoral process, that's when you know society's crumbling, because our friend and new congresswoman from this area, Sheila Sherfalus McCormick. She beat her opponent.
This is great.
By almost 60 points. And this is a Trumplican that ran against her.
In a blue district, mind you.
Is refusing to concede the election.
This is 78. Wait, this is it. She defeated him 78.7% to 19.6%, and he won't concede.
No.
Now, obviously, to me, I just look at that totally as just a
rigged.
Media stunt.
It's totally rigged.
It's a media
it's
stunt.
It's totally rigged. I totally won the race. I didn't even run the district, but I totally won.
I just think that's a media stunt, but it's just sort of, you know.
But who's to say that this isn't going to happen in races everywhere?
They're just going to challenge it. That's Why the thing. We're you? Undermining the entire thing. Why would you?
And nobody believes in the sanctity of the vote anymore. And it has nothing to do with the voting rights bill. It has to do with the fact that you cheat anyway. Who cares?
The guy, Mariner, filed a lawsuit before the election was called. He filed a lawsuit telling CBS Miami that stuff was discovered. So he sounds like what Trump sounds like about, you know, the election fraud.
But we do have a little bit of good news, which is kind of interesting, considering that Florida is a right-to-work state. First, Starbucks in Florida files for union representation.
This pleases me, in Tallahassee.
I would say that is pretty damn awesome. And this is why, as we talked about, what happened in Bessemer, Alabama with the Amazon workers, what happened with the Starbucks workers in Buffalo, it just takes one. And
I just want to promote this one. Everybody in Tallahassee.
Friend of the show, More Perfect Union.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say this, that it's the one located at John Knox Road and North Monroe Street. Guys, go to that Starbucks. Be supportive.
Hell yes. See
them outside trying to unionize. Be supportive. So that's the one that this is. And yeah, More Perfect Union tweeted out that employees at 7 Starbucks locations have filed for union
election. This is how it happens, baby.
In the last 2 weeks, the one in Tallahassee is the first one of those in Florida. So it's very exciting.
Unions are absolutely an endangered, that's not how you spell it, but I know what you're saying. It is an endangered species in Florida. And of course, it is endangered. Why? Because Florida is a right-to-work state. And this is one of the biggest reasons why we don't have a strong labor movement. But that is obviously something we would be looking to change. It takes time, but we fight for it.
So we're happy to report that one of those is in Tallahassee, which, again, proves our point that while Florida is red, it is populist. It is. We did vote for a $15 minimum wage here. So I'm just saying. So, again, I'm pleased that this is happening
in Florida. And if that's not enough, IKEA...
This what pleases wonderful, me too.
Well, of course, the Swedes always do fantastic stuff, don't they?
Okay, I want to read this because I want to make sure I get it right.
So IKEA will restore 3,000 acres of land in Florida that were harmed by Hurricane Michael.
Yeah, so this, guys, for people who don't know Florida, this is in the Panhandle area. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's really cool about this is it's an area that is called Tupelo honey, and it's where Tupelo honey is from. And it's a very special kind of honey, which just to me also... Big props, Van Morrison song called Tupelo Honey, one of the best songs ever. But anyway, so
Brown Eyed Girl.
No, Tupelo Honey. But so IKEA just bought over 3,000 acres in land. It's the Inca, it's INGKA Group, the company that controls IKEA. In January, they purchased 2 plots of land spanning 3,264 acres near the Apalachicola River. So that's in the Panhandle area. The land is called Tupelo Honey, and they plan to treat the new purchase as an afforestation project. I don't know what that means. Oh, instead of reforestation, afforestation. So while reforestation refers to the replanting of trees where there once was trees, afforestation is when people plant seeds that will grow into trees and eventually a forest on land that had not been previously a forest. So they're creating a forest in an area that was decimated. Which is very, very nice.
Guys would find it very interesting because, we hear about, conservatives who say climate change is a hoax, and yet the red counties always seem to be so much more environmentally conscious than the blue counties.
Yeah, for sure.
So everything is up is down, left is right. It's so unbelievable.
It is estimated that 650,000 or more trees will be planted in Tupelo honey over the next 40 years. as the forest will operate on a 40-year cycle. That's more technical than I need to get into. But anyway, I was pleased. And yay,
IKEA. Hats off to IKEA, as always.
Apparently, Tupelo Honey is not IKEA's first forest. Mm. So apparently they've done this in grow sustainable timber in U.S. and Europe. Interesting.
Scandinavia leading the way, as they always do.
Seriously.
And so our final story of the night is one that we could simply not ignore. And Jen, this is something that you can take, because the freaking balls that politicians have when they just throw terms out there
they're Nazis. Like it's nothing. It's Trump.
Everybody's a Nazi. Everybody's Hitler. Punch a Nazi. It's like, there is a lack of sense that so many people have. That's incredible. And Commissioner of Agriculture turned gubernatorial candidate Nikki Fried, who is desperately trying to make a big splash as the candidate, and she is trying to win the nomination.
But if anybody can't see my graphic, it says campaign strategy, play the Hitler card.
Right there.
And it's honestly, you should be embarrassed. Plus, she should be embarrassed for this tweet that she put out, because now I am reading this from the New York Post, but they have it in quotes. So
just what did she say?
I'm putting it out there. She was talking about DeSantis, and that's what dictators do. Instead of listening and trying to govern with the people, he is trying to govern over the people. And you know that, I'm sorry, I'm a student of history too. I saw the rise of Hitler. Really? Nikki, you saw that?
If anything, he's the opposite of Hitler, because this is a state that would not tolerate. You want to know what this state would look like if you put it in lockdown? Do you want to know what would happen in Florida?
Right. Hitler would be having vaccine and mask mandates. That would be more Hitler-esque. That's what I would just say.
It's just this whole knee-jerk reaction.
I saw the rise of Hitler.
Yeah, it's the knee-jerk reaction to just go to the lowest hanging fruit, the lowest common denominator, and that's crappy politics. State your case.
And not only that, but here's another thing. So she was asked if she was in fact comparing DeSantis to Hitler. And she goes, in a lot of ways, yes. I have studied Hitler and how he got to power, you know, wanting his own militia. Okay. Yeah, I do recognize that DeSantis did say that. We actually covered that a little bit here.
Half the states in the country have to say
But no. It's not something that's going to happen. And he didn't even assign a budget for it. And as somebody who is in her position, she should really understand that it wasn't something that's going to happen. And that, like, she's being very hyperbolic. And it's obviously part of a strategy, because it's just absurd.
Yeah, but I don't think that that's what's going to win her.
No.
Well,
I don't think anything's going to win
her. Listen, we've been on record. It's not to say anything negative, but DeSantis is not losing re-election.
No.
And if we're going to be more honest, I like what Kayla has to say. Look, Sheila is going to have a hell of a the one re-election that she's going to be really heavily challenged in is this one coming up in August, because Dale Holness is coming for her again. He's already announced he's going to. Why wouldn't he? 5 votes. Of course, he's going to run. And the district is going to be expecting some things out of her. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens there.
I mean, the reality is, and when Sheila ran, she ran by promising everybody $1,000. And there was a big billboard, and I mean big billboard, not like the kind of campaign billboards, but like a real off the highway billboard where Sheila basically off with $1,000. And I have been in several situations amongst voters in that district that have said they voted for her for that money. So my concern is when you promise something that's like a fixed thing, it's, you know, very, very definitive thing, and then you can't come through, that is not good.
I also think, we're very likely going to have Senator Annette DeDeo on the podcast soon. And, you know, she'll talk about her campaign. We have no preference, you know, at the end of the day.
No, not really. The truth is we just don't think whoever that is.
Whoever is ultimately going to run, you would just hope that they're going to create whatever momentum they can to keep building initiatives. See, for us, what really matters in 22 is not who's going to beat DeSantis, because he's not going to be beat. But it's a question of, can we get these very important ballot initiatives across the finish line with a good candidate, a candidate that people feel at least somewhat excited about.
And that's the problem.
Yeah. Championing ranked choice voting and home grow for legalization of cannabis. Those are the two primary issues on the ballot.
Oh, can I tell you something else that's really important that we need to be fighting against? Is the legislation
for the legalization of
gambling? No, okay. No. That they're wanting to
raise the needed percentage to pass a ballot initiative to 66%. It used to be 51
or 50
point. Then it got pushed to 60. And now that we were able to get stuff passed, there is now something that is one of the big things that they're trying to push through this year. And that is something we're going to have to be extremely diligent about. So I just want to say, like, that's a big issue.
It's going to go to 100% before you're able to get anywhere.
Right. So it's a real problem. It's a real problem.
We obviously are huge supporters of Anne Escamani. We 100% support her reelection.
And I like Annette Tadeo. I've met Annette. Yeah. I think she's really nice. I think she's, for the most part, she's been on the right side of stuff.
No, she's very personable.
She's very nice. You know. And I do think that, like, for me, you know, I would prefer her to Charlie Crist, just personally for me, in terms of who I think is, you know, coming up in that. I think he's sort of been there, done that already. And so, you know.
And then finally, Maxwell Frost. He's done a really good job of raising money. He does have David Hogue and a couple of others from the March for Our Lives movement. Obviously, for those who know, Parkland is the most affluent suburb.
I'd love to get all of those people on.
Yeah, we would definitely.
I'd love to have Maxwell, a Democrat forum on that. A Democrat forum for governor. That would be awesome.
Well, we're going to be working on one for Texas, preferably for February. But on Wednesday, we do have a awesome candidate who's coming on. Nabila Islam will be her first time on the show. She ran for Congress.
She was supposed to be on last week, and we had to postpone.
Yep, she's part of Jen Slate, was part of Jen Slate with Brand New Congress. She is now running for the state Senate in Georgia, which is actually very smart because
Georgia, adorable, by the way.
Yeah, and Georgia is going to be basically between Georgia and Pennsylvania. You're looking at the two true eye of the hurricane states in this year. Stacey Abrams obviously running for governor. It is a red wave year, but what's interesting about what's happening in Georgia is there really is a civil war in the GOP. You've got Brian Kemp, who's trying to save his neck as governor, and you've got David Perdue, who was just senator, who is now being backed by Trump in a primary for the governor's race. Very interesting. So Georgia will take center stage. And then, of course, we are going to have a crossover podcast with a gentleman by the name of Osiris, who does Stuck in the Middle. He is somebody who has...
I was not familiar with prior to knowing about this, but that's okay.
But really awesome guy, has some really strong opinions. I think we'll have a great conversation with him. And we're going to have some other big guests that are going to be coming along the end of the month. So now...
What do we have? We have exciting stuff?
Yes. Well, you know, if you want us to let you know now, next Monday, we are going to be speaking with none other than Michael E. Mann. He's coming back to the podcast. He is the inspiration for the Leonardo DiCaprio character in
Don't Look Up, which is so funny to me that he is.
So that'll be interesting. And then on the following Wednesday.
Oh, also, I want to tell people that next week is the ribbon cutting for the Hallandale High Garden that anybody who is a patron, we gave $200 to that. So we were invited to the ribbon cutting
and
to the community garden.
And what a perfect event to do prior to speaking with Mr. Environment himself.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot. We got a lot going on. We hope you guys enjoyed it. Obviously, you know, check out the interview with Ash Kalra. We'll do a clip from that. Very important what's going on in California.
If you live in California, please bug the crap out of your assembly member.
Mr. Grumbine, I think Mr. Kalros makes a very good case. I think he stated exactly how they're going to pay for it and how there is going to not be the shortfall that you are concerned about at the state level, but this could be an ironclad, and that would be obviously huge. And of course, what can we say about Margaret Kimberly? One of our absolute favorites, always great to talk to, and we love
guys, if you haven't read her book, her last book was called Prejudential. It was great. I did I did the audio, and Margaret does her own audio. So it's like having this nice private lecture from her, which I like very much.
I'll come back and I come on your show.
I was so impressed that you were able to get that Marcel Dixon on so fast. So guys,
you're talking to me.
No,
I'm coming up with the environment.
Guys, Jim Clyburn has a primary challenger.
He sure does.
And this pleases me no end.
And he was just on Friend of the Show, Tim Black, the other day.
The gentleman's name is Marcel Dixon. Mm. And we are going to shower him with as much love and support as we possibly can, because this man is stepping up Jim Clyburn.
Big time.
And we need to get behind that.
Damn right, Purse. We agree on that. Guys, a pleasure as always. We'll see you Wednesday.
Bye, y'all.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.